Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum. We've gathered a panel of scientific experts to respond to your questions and comments. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can go to our website, wamc.org/voxpop. There's a spot to put your questions or comments there. You could comment on Facebook. We have a Vox Pop wall post. It's Vox Pop. It's WAMC Radio on Facebook is what it is. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But we do love your calls, 1-800-348-2551. And so without further ado, let's meet the scientists.
I'm Ed Stender, geologist, astronomer, and general know-it-all from SUNY Cobleskill.
Mr. Know-it-all. All right.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, sort of retired.
Okay. Well, nice to have you guys here. And the big news that we have been watching sort of casually in the newsroom is of the Comet lander. And it was a somewhat successful landing. It bounced around a bit, but it stayed on. And I heard today that they have found carbon-based molecules? Yeah?
Yeah.
And so what does that mean? Why is that such an exciting discovery?
Well, that's a chemistry question.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's important to find it on the comet. Ed and I were discussing. It's not particularly surprising because these kinds of molecules are seen and been found in space commonly.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been surprising not to find molecules like that.
So we were excited for no reason then in the newsroom.
Oh, no, we were excited because we had just spent $1 billion getting on the comet, and we found what we expected.
Europeans spent it.
Well, that's true.
So,
but basically, there's three types of carbon, main types of carbon. There's carbon 12, 13, and 14. And carbon 12 is organic carbon. So if they find that one, that tells you something about it. But just as an example, we found organic carbon on the Earth going back almost 4 billion years. And the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously it got here somehow, and it's very possible that it got here the same way, through comets. In fact, many people have suggested that the oceans are basically cometary material that landed early on, and that's where we got it from.
That would have to be a lot of comets.
There were a lot of comets back then.
Less now.
Yeah. Mainly because back in the old days, the comets had very elliptical orbits. And so as a result, they would intersect with the Earth quite a bit. But over time, those elliptical orbits become slightly more round.
And some comets will lose all of their stuff as they go by the sun, as we saw earlier in the year.
Yeah, they lose their sun, they fall into the sun. And if we happen to be in the wrong spot, they hit us.
Fair enough.
They probably did in Russia a couple of years ago.
Was it only last year?
This was Tuguska.
Oh, in 1908.
Right. Whatever it was, yep.
1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Let's go to Maria in Bethlehem.
It's actually Mario.
You sound more like a Mario than a Maria. Well, you're on, Mario. Go ahead.
And I think you might have just answered my question about the organic.
No.
Ask it anyway. We got time.
Well, I'll ask a different question. Do you know if we're working on a similar type of of project as far as doing a landing on a comet?
Oh, if we're doing the same sort of thing?
Right, if we're working on, you know, a similar type of project to do that in the future.
I don't know if there's an American project or a NASA project specifically on a comet.
We were involved in the, I imagine that we were involved with this one, although it was the European Space Agency that put it down. I'm sure we were involved, and we were also involved with the Halley's Comet close encounter of a couple of years ago.
So what can be learned that by landing on one that really can't be learned by examining from a small distance the comet?
Well, we learn a lot, actually, just by looking at it with spectroscopes. For example, when Halley's Comet came by last time in 1900s, early 1900s, they thought that it contained arsenic because we found arsenic in the signature of the comet.
Mm-hmm.
And since we were going to pass through its tail, everyone was going to die.
Ah.
And they were selling comet pills and all sorts of things. What you can't get is what's going on right at the comet itself without interaction with the solar wind. For example, in this case, probably the amount of carbon that they're measuring, which is right around the nucleus of the comet in the atmosphere, they probably wouldn't be able to find that in the mix of chemicals that come out the back and the tail. So you get a lot more information that way.
All right.
Anyway, that's my guess.
Mario, you got a follow-up?
I don't.
Well, thank you very much for calling. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Of course, the lander landed in a shadow.
Right.
And so it's in sleep mode now. I think they managed to move it a little bit. But we may not hear much from that particular comet until spring. But what is spring on a comet?
It may be when it's just closer to the sun.
Hmm. So it may come back to life.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, as the comet goes through, it's going to rotate to some extent in any case. So it's very possible. Like, I believe when it first landed, they thought they'd get maybe a couple of hours. They might not even get that much information because the solar cells were off. But it's obviously been working for at least 6 or 7 days.
What would have been shocking had they found it on the comet, chemically?
Reruns of Gilligan's Island.
You know, Ed.
What would be shocking, a joke that I made to Ed, would be organic compounds that have what would be called chirality or handedness to them, because your body, life, makes complicated organic molecules that are in a particular shape, like a left-hand glove as opposed to a right-hand glove.
Wow.
So if you found only right-hand molecules, then that would say that life almost surely had to create those molecules. That would have been shocking.
No evidence of anything like that so far?
No, I can't imagine.
That actually gives rise to my favorite word, enantiomorphism.
Okay.
Which is one of these words that I used in Scrabble once.
You can spell it?
Oh, yeah. Enantiomorphism, of course.
Very impressive.
Anyway, so I'm a scientist. But enantiomorphism is handedness, whether something is right-handed or left-handed.
Yeah.
And it's a upper-level structure, if you will, upper-level function that you don't see in simple molecules.
I've heard theories through the years that comets sort of seeded the Earth for life. So could there be a possibility of amino acids or anything of the sort on a comet, or would that be out of the question?
No, that would certainly be possible. I mean, I don't know what the organic matter was that was detected, but it would be of the form that if it was complicated enough to have what's termed chirality, there would be both the left-hand and the right-hand forms in equal amounts.
We're joined today by Jim Pickett and Ed Stander, and you. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to John in Greenville. John, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, scientists. I have something I'd like to bring up about amphibians. And to me, it seems like a big thing, and maybe not to other people, but we have an artificial sort of environment we've created that attracts a lot of frogs during the summer months. And we have like a pond and a stream and a fountain and everything. And we can get considerable numbers of amphibians in there and other types of, you know, salamanders and things. But then when the weather starts cooling off, they don't disappear. And the problem is that it's artificial. There's no environment for them to winter over in. And there's a lot of issues that cause their demise if they remain there. And when you multiply that out amongst a lot of unnatural environments that have been created across the state and around the country now, that people have all these artificial sort of ponds and things, I'd like to maybe have you talk about that. And I do have a thing that we do to try and avoid that problem in the winter. But I'd like, you know, anybody have a comment on that?
Well, it's sort of out of our bailiwick, being chemists and geologists, but yeah. Do you have anything to say?
Is the pond, does it have a soft bottom, or is it a hard bottom?
No, it's plastic. It's plastic.
Oh.
As with all of them, they're all either, you know, rubber liners and things and that type of thing. And maybe it's something that somebody could take for homework or when there's another person on the next show.
Yeah, I don't know what you could do about it with a plastic bottle.
What we end up doing is actually removing them all and moving them a short distance into the marshes around our property where they probably come from initially anyway.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
All right.
But, you know, I'm just saying there's millions of them that don't get moved and that just perish over the winter.
Yeah. Great point. John, thanks a lot.
Okay, well, thank you for the show.
And Ed, thanks for saying Ballywick. Really appreciate that. That was very nice.
It's, again, one of my science words for the week.
And I assume you can spell that as well.
Ballywick. It's a Y, not an I.
It's an I.
It is. I thought it was
well,
an I.
Well, maybe Shakespeare used a Y. I mean,
oh,
we don't know.
I've got to go now.
1-800-348-2551 is the number. It's a science forum. It's rather a free-flowing event. If you have any kind of question at all, give us a shout. 1-800-348-2551. Back in a flash.
Support for WAMC comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York. Protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974, preservenys.org. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock and Rhinebeck, now offering hot foods, smoothies, and soups at the Rhinebeck Stores Cafe and Juice Bar at 24 Garden Street on Facebook and sunflowernatural.com. HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting The Jungle Book, weekends December 12th through the 21st at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. And Hudson Kitchen and Bath, a design-build firm specializing in kitchen and bathroom remodeling, located at 304 Warren Street, Hudson, New York, hudsonkb.com.
Well, hello again, everyone. It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum. Ray Graff here, joined by Ed Stander and Jim Pickett, and you at home. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. And here is one from Mirka, who says, "Hi, Ray and guests. My question concerns the design of the large wind turbines. Why do they look like sailboats without their sails up? How do they catch the wind with such skinny blades? Seems counterintuitive." All right, scientists.
It does seem counterintuitive, but I think what's important is the size of the circle that's swept out and not the size of the blades.
Oh, interesting.
So
I'm sure that there's a relationship between the size of the blade, the amount it can turn to get out of the wind if it has to go too fast, which is important, and the sail size. It's the sail size that really determines how much energy. And considering the length of the blades and the size of the blades, they have more than enough sail to operate the way it is. If they made them larger, they'd probably be hitting a lot more animals as well, a lot more birds. So by making them smaller, they're making it a little safer.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Eric in Saratoga. Eric, you're on.
My question is, on the probe that you were talking about a little while ago, why did they not use a secondary power source, say a fuel cell, knowing that the solar array could
I was wondering the same thing. I thought maybe a small nuclear battery of some kind that they've used before on these sort of things.
Well, they've only used them once before, and that was with the Viking landers. They're not allowed to use them because we're not allowed to put radioactivity in space.
Ah.
So that's the problem.
Presumably there is radioactivity in space already, though, yes?
Yes, but we're not putting it there.
I see.
So,
right, but I mean, a fuel cell or, you know, something that would get it so when it's in a dark zone, it still functions. I mean, it just seems kind of counterintuitive.
It's probably a matter of the weight trade-off, that having the fuel cell and the fuel you would need, because you would need a tank of liquid oxygen
and
liquid hydrogen. You'd have to keep it liquid for that long.
And it's rather cold out in space. In fact, things don't work very well out in space at those temperatures, not even batteries, which is why that they could only get 8 or 9 hours out of the battery. It had to be with solar cells because they require the least energy to get them up there.
Okay. Great question, though, Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Assad in Poughkeepsie. You're on.
Hi. So, question about the comet's tail. I guess the understanding that I had was that tail is maybe like water or some sort of vapor sublimating off the comet. I guess maybe they didn't find that effect in this recent mission. I don't know if I'm reading these articles correctly. And so the question is that some people are proposing that the tail actually is a function of an electrical interaction with the solar wind, the sun in general. Like it's an electrical phenomenon. Like, can you guys kind of comment on that?
Is it close enough to the sun for the sublimation to happen yet?
Once it gets past Jupiter, it gets close enough to the sun.
Okay.
And the length of the comet's tail can be on the order of an astronomical unit. It's 93 million miles long, which suggests all by itself that it can't be made out of particulate matter, or else the comets wouldn't exist anymore. So also, the comet's tail always points away from the sun.
Mm.
So, for example, when the comet's going away from the sun, the tail's actually in front of it, not behind it.
Okay.
And that's because it's the solar wind that's interacting with the cometary material that's making it happen.
Okay. Great question. Thank you. Let's go to Sam in Beckett, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the Science Forum.
Hi. I have a question about the soil here, I think. I'm from the Midwest originally. I moved out here about a year ago. But in the spring, it was just, like, insanely muddy. And that's not something that I'm used to. And talking to folks out here, they said that, yeah, like, how could you possibly have spring without tons of mud? And I was just wondering if you could inform me about what the difference would have been in the soil that would create that.
Where do you live? Where do you live?
I live in Beckett, so like Western Massachusetts.
Okay. Well, a couple of things happened around here that didn't happen in the Midwest. One of them was a major glaciation, especially up in the Albany area, this area, where an awful lot of rock from Canada was ground up and left behind. And so a lot of the stuff that's in the soil, it's not good sand like you find out west. It's sand mixed up with rock flour and an awful lot of feldspar, because we have a lot of granite around here.
Mm.
And granite is effectively, when you take feldspar and break it apart, it forms little plates, very, very microscopic plates. You put that under pressure, it becomes something that's almost semi-solid, like clay or mud, and it doesn't let water through. So you've got two problems. You've got dirty soils, and you've got all this rock flour doesn't let anything through, and then you have the feldspar material, the mud, that just doesn't allow it through. It's called an aquiclute because the water just can't get through it. So, yeah, it's a wonderful thing. I love living around here.
It's tough to grow grass, though. It really is with all that clay.
Well, you know, where I live right now, we've got clay everywhere, and the grass grows beautifully.
You aerate?
Lots of nutrients.
But you need to get...
You have to aerate to some extent, but not very much. The bad places are the places that are covered with sand. Because when the glacier
right
left,
through.
This whole area was sand dunes. And sand dunes, you can't grow anything on it.
Fair enough. Sam, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551 is the number here on Vox Pop. Let's go over to Joe in New Paltz. Joe, you're on.
How's it going, guys?
Good.
So I have an organic chemistry question. I've been following the development of graphene as a material since it was first discovered, I think it was like in 2008 by the physicists. And they've made, like, tons of strides in the physics realm of actually creating graphene and using, like, light scribe technology. And some people are actually doing DIY production of graphene using, you know, standard electronics. But it seems that despite graphene's, you know, amazing potential as a material for from everything from, like, storage as a super, super capacitor to water filtration, the thing that's prohibiting the creation of graphene is actually producing the graphite oxide. And it seems to be very expensive to purchase graphite oxide. So I was wondering, you know, what makes it so expensive to take graphite and turn it into graphite oxide, which is a prerequisite to making graphene? And how can we make it cheaper? Because if we did have graphene, we could potentially have, you know, electric cars that charge in a, you know, a couple minutes versus the hours that conventional batteries. So I'll let you guys go, and I'll listen to the radio. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Joe. All right.
Yeah, I haven't followed this in great detail. The problem is getting the layers of the graphene apart in graphite. It's called exfoliation.
Okay.
And so you could have a nice big piece of graphite, and you just want to lift off one or two layers from the surface. There's not a good way to do that. So I mean, the original way that the graphene was characterized was just by pulling it off with Scotch tape.
Yeah.
But But now your graphene's stuck to the scotch tape. You can't get it back off on the other side very easily. And there again, you're not going to be making big sheets that way. So synthesizing things that are just one molecule thick and in a controlled way is difficult. And apparently that it is especially difficult in the case of graphene. I mean, one would think you would approach this by taking a silicon wafer and depositing carbon on it slowly to try to get one molecule thick. Obviously, that doesn't work. The magic conditions have not been found to grow it on a clean surface.
All right. Well, assuming they're trying to do it, it's just too expensive to do it now, or you can't do it at all?
It can be done apparently on very small samples. So you can do all sorts of marvelous things on a square millimeter, but then to get that scaled up, you know, to a square foot size, it apparently is harder than it looks.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Hilda in Russell, Mass. Hilda, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, I'm responding to the amphibians dying over the winter in the small ponds.
Yeah.
And I have found, and this is what I do, that if you keep the water open to some extent by putting in a small pump that keeps the water moving, it'll give them enough air so they actually, you know, enough air will go into the water. So they actually will survive. And I've been successful with that, and I thought perhaps it would be one way of keeping more amphibians alive over the winter.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. Gentlemen, you want to weigh in on that?
Sounds like a good idea. You'd probably have to have a fairly large pond so that you won't just churn the water over and freeze it all the way through.
Yeah.
But
All right, let's go to Bruce in Conway. Bruce, you're on.
Yeah, I had just one comment about the amphibians. It seems as if they've been doing pretty well for hundreds of millions of years. I not really have to worry about them.
Well, I guess the ponds haven't been around. The man-made ponds haven't been around for hundreds of millions of years. I think that's the issue.
Right, and there's also the question that there are amphibians and then there are your amphibians.
Right, that's a good point. What's your other question, Bruce?
My other question was, I've always wondered about why we couldn't dump the radioactive waste from nuclear power plants into the sun if it were financially feasible and if there weren't a prohibition on radioactive material going out into space. Wouldn't the sun be able to just absorb a tiny speck of those, what we've got, you know, waste from nuclear power plants? Wouldn't it be just like a drop in the bucket?
Sure. Yeah, that would be a great place to put it, except for the tremendous expense of getting it up, of launching it, and the risks
right.
of something bad happening and blowing it up in the atmosphere, which would be a major
catastrophe.
That'd
be a bad thing.
That would ruin your whole day.
There's also the problem that nuclear waste comes in different levels. You've got high-level nuclear waste. You've got low-level nuclear waste. For example, decommissioning a power plant produces tons and tons of nuclear waste. And there's very little ways of getting all that into a rocket and out into space. It would cost much, much too much.
Okay. Because, I mean, once you got it into space, you could do many things. You could dump it on the far side of the moon or anything you want. It's just getting it out of the atmosphere. Bruce, thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. Joe in Colony.
Hey, Jim. It's Joe.
Hi.
How you doing? Two things. You said you weren't sure that there was NASA working with this. Both NASA has instruments on both Rosetta and Philae.
Right.
Okay.
Great.
And secondly, you said there were no things running around space with nuclear power. Curiosity is that was one of the things that Curiosity actually has a small nuclear power generator, so that's why it's able to run around, you know, without having to worry about, you know, when the sun's up.
You mean on Mars? Oh.
Even on Mars.
Yeah.
Yep. I'll check that. I didn't realize that, but I'll certainly check
on it. Yeah, no, I mean, Dr. Darby Dyer did that at a club meeting a couple of months ago.
Oh, very interesting. Well, thanks, Joe. Appreciate the call.
Okay, and see you tomorrow. Bye.
Okay.
Fair enough. All right. You know.
He's Joe Slomka. He's president of the local amateur astronomers association.
Okay. Well,
so how
could
I compete with that?
That's right. Sorry? Let's go to Patricia in Walden. Patricia, you're on the Science Forum.
Hi. I had a question about, I saw about 3 weeks ago or so.
Yeah.
I woke up around 1:30 in the morning, and I noticed kind of a flashing near my window. So I looked out, and it was kind of like, almost like heat lightning that you see in the winter, in the summer, I mean. But it was moving along the horizon, and it went on for at least 2 hours. And I couldn't find any explanation because I looked on the different websites for astronomy events and that. And I still don't know what it could have been.
Did it wake you up, Patricia?
No, it didn't wake. There was no noise. It was totally silent. But it was just a very bright light shining along a portion of the horizon, and then it moved. It would move, like, from one side to the other.
Huh.
So
I have no idea what that could be.
I certainly heard nothing about it.
All right, so let me follow up then. Was it, what were the atmospheric conditions? Was it cloudy? Was it foggy?
It was very clear. It was a very clear night, and I watched until, like, a kind of heavy cloud moved in. And then, of course, I couldn't see it anymore. And then it started raining very heavily. So I don't know if maybe it was associated with, you know, that was a storm farther away. But
sounds
it just
like
seems strange, you know, to have lightning at this time of year.
Hmm.
Well, what are they called? St. Elmo's fire. There are a number of things like that, but they're not usually very bright. And seeing it from the horizon would be very unlikely.
Yeah. But you said if it did rain, if it was clear and then rapidly clouded up
and
rain.
Right, right. And then after about 2 hours, it started getting foggy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then it just started raining very heavily.
Okay.
Yeah. It could have been just the lightning then with a front coming through.
Yeah, so we can't say for sure, but at least that would be one option.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thanks a lot,
Thank
Patricia.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call.
Bye.
Let's go over to Don and Jewett. Don, you're on.
I like to ask, how do these asteroids and comets get their locomotion in the first place, and do they ever slow down or eventually end stop?
Okay.
What gives them propulsion?
Well, effectively gravity. They're attracted by gravity towards the sun, and then as they go around the sun, as they get closer, they speed up. It's one of Kepler's laws, effectively, that says that as you get closer to something, you wind up going faster. And so it gets slingshot back out into space until it gets picked up, slows down enough to get picked up by the gravity again, and then comes back in again. So it just makes this large elliptical circle continuously.
Mm.
Okay, so we don't know, like, this one's never going to come back again. Could it ever stop?
There are two types of comets. There's long-term comets and short-term comets. And the long-term comets usually come from away from the orbit of the planets and come out from way out in space, left field, and they show up and they're gone again. Hale Bopp a couple years ago, it'll be back in about 2,500 years.
Mm.
So if you missed it, you missed it.
Didn't miss it.
Right.
It was great.
And then you've got comets like Halley's Comet that come back every 70-odd years. And again, it's because they're in these cases, they're short-term comets that probably formed at the same time as the solar system.
Wow.
So
okay,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Don. Appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. We're joined by Ed Stander and Jim Pickett. And let's go to Ed in Lake Katrine. Ed.
Hi. First, a spelling correction.
Okay.
I looked it up in the dictionary, bailiwick.
Okay.
Bailiwick.
Okay. Well, Ed is...
I'm chagrined,
okay.
And I'm not going to spell it.
Fair enough.
But this may be out of your guess, bailiwick.
Yes.
Oh, nice.
But there's been a huge snowstorm in our state, and it's one of the biggest ever. And I'm wondering how many of these unprecedented big storms that come along about every year or so become proof of global climate change, not just unusual episodes.
Well, first of all, the storm that's hitting us right now, and those kinds of storms are local phenomenon, to the point, for example, in the case of the Buffalo phenomenon, two blocks away from where the snow is hitting, there's no snow.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and the only relationship it would have on a long, even on a short term with global warming, is if the water that's forming the snow was warmer than usual because of global warming. In other words, there was more energy in the system. And whether that would be the case or not, it's a, if it is a variation, it's probably an extremely small effect because lakes go through warmer periods and colder periods in general. It's just the nature of the beast.
Ed, thanks a lot. We'll take a break here. It's the Science Forum. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. We'll get back to your calls in a moment.
Support for WMT comes from the Cheese Traveler, Albany, New York. Featuring over 100 cheeses, cured meats, grilled cheese sandwiches, Tilldale Farm organic beef and pork, artisan pantry items, and cheese classes, thecheesetraveler.com. H. Houst & Son True Value Hardware, Woodstock, locally owned since 1932, offering holiday decorations and gifts for kitchen, workshop, and home. Behind every project is a true value. HHoust.com. 10,000 Villages in Stuyvesant Plaza, Albany, featuring fairly traded home decor and gifts handcrafted by artisans around the world. 10,000villages.com for additional store locations. And Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, presenting Judy Collins, singing her songs as well as Irish tunes, featured in her new PBS concert special, Friday at 8 p.m., troymusichall.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. About every month or so, we convene the Science Forum. Today, we're joined by Jim Pickett and Ed Stander. Sometimes we have three, sometimes we have two, sometimes we have four. Today, we have two, and they're doing a fine job. Here, one gentleman is from email. Says, thank you for taking my question. Well, let's see if we can answer it first. Can you please talk about what causes earthquakes, what causes them to suddenly happen, and is there a relationship between earthquakes and plate tectonics? Is there any way for us to better predict where and when they will occur? And that's from Mark.
Well, Mark, I can tell you, first of all, that we're lucky that there aren't many around here, because earthquakes around here are few and far between. They're caused mostly by the Adirondacks rising as they erode. So we're in a pretty earthquake-free area, but generally speaking, earthquakes occur around plate boundaries. And there's several types. If two plates are opening up, then you get what are called normal faults, and these are relatively short, quick, shallow earthquakes. If you happen to be near a place where one plate is going underneath another, then you can get some much more deeper earthquakes that are much more effective in destroying houses.
And the deeper they are, the more destructive they can be?
Not necessarily, but basically what happens in an earthquake is the rocks break. And if the rocks are under a lot of pressure before they break, then the earthquake is big. If there's a lot of earthquakes, they're usually very small. So it really all depends on what's the precursor to the situation. For example, in California, you've got an area like Northridge, down south, further south in California, where you have earthquakes almost every 8 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rock is slowly relieving its pressure. When you finally get up to places like San Francisco, the fault is actually caught. It can't move. And as a result, the pressure is building up more and more until finally when it does go, it's catastrophic.
Do you remember the earthquake a couple of years, maybe three or four now, in the Virginia, Washington, D.C. area that we felt here, and I was in the newsroom, and it, almost to the point of causing nausea, it was quite strong here.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, the geologists at the time said, this was a bit different. It almost rang like a bell.
Right.
And that has to do with what the ground is made of around here?
It's not what it's around here as much as what it is there. For example, if you have an earthquake within a granite body, it'll tend to break much more suddenly, and it rings a lot more. If it's in soils, you don't have as much an effect, and if it's deeper, you don't have as much an effect. So if it's near the surface, it'll travel within the surface much faster and much cleaner than it would if it's deeper.
All right. Well, the email address, once again, voxpop@wamc.org. Thank you for that question, Mark. And back to the phones we go. We go to Rhett at Port Jervis. Rhett, you're on.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about plants and soil. I love to garden, and I'm pretty good at it. But I don't, and I never have been able to understand what exactly is happening between the sun and the photosynthesis that the plant can go through, take the sun's energy and create food for itself, and soil, the nutrients in the soil, and the way that they have to be there also for this plant to grow and be healthy and produce fruit. What's going on there? Like, I've heard the term cation exchange, and I think that may be an electrical charge of some kind, but can your guests enlighten me a little bit so that I can hopefully try to understand that better?
All right.
Thanks, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Rhett.
Okay, what the plant has to take out of the soil that it can't make itself will be nitrogen-containing compounds, because you need those to make amino acids, to make proteins. You also need them to make nucleic acids. You need phosphorus to make phospholipids, which are around the cell membranes. And you need the cations. The cations mean are just positively charged atoms.
Okay.
So of those, potassium is important, sodium is important, and small amounts of other metals are important. You have to have magnesium. Magnesium is what's in chlorophyll, right?
Mm.
Yeah, so you have to have magnesium. You also need trace amounts of other elements, metals, to get up into there in order to build all the things that you need to do to make cells.
Okay. And how do you make the cellulose that's the plant?
Okay, well, that's what the plant's making with the sunlight and carbon dioxide and water. The plant then can make the sugar-like molecules for its own metabolism and also to build the structure of the plant.
Okay. Over to Kathleen in Worthington. Kathleen, you're on. Oops, let's hit the button there, Ray. You dope. Kathleen in Worthington, you're on.
Yeah, I'm in Worthington, Mass., which I think is southeast of Albany.
Okay.
And I just wanted to call because of the lady who called from Walden, New York.
Yeah.
Who saw the lights.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know where that is exactly compared to where I am. Is it south wherever of Albany? I don't know. But I wanted to say I saw the same thing.
Really?
Yes, I did. And I don't know that it woke me up, but boy, it was this bright light flashing and flashing. And when I was telling a friend of mine about it a day or so later, I said I thought an NSA drone was coming for me, you know.
Well, I bet there wouldn't be any flashing lights on that.
It was very weird because I've never seen anything like it, except, as she said, I did also think of heat lightning. And I kept waiting for the thunder to happen. There was never any thunder. But then eventually, and it did go on for some time, as it sort of moved across the sky, I think it was sort of, I could say it was heading southeast. The wind seemed to come up a little bit, and then there was a little rain. Never any thunder, and I think I was thinking that we had been forecast for a storm, so that's why I was sort of anticipating the thunder and the downpour, but it didn't. It was just a bit of wind and a bit of rain.
Hmm.
But it was just weird, and I thought, uh-oh, somebody's coming for me, you know?
Did it come as flashes, or was it continuous light?
No, flashes.
It was flashes.
It sounds like lightning over the horizon.
Yeah, and that irregular, not
well, you know,
not
I was
spaced
trying,
exactly.
I didn't get out of bed. I just was too sleepy to get out of bed, but I was trying to count the seconds in between each one, because that's why I was thinking it was some man-made thing, because they seemed to be like 10 seconds apart, but then it changed.
Yeah.
And it would go to 17 seconds, and it would go to 5 seconds, and so...
My money's on lightning.
The other possibility, actually possibly associated with that, is there may have been refraction in the atmosphere If you have a certain situation where you've got cold air and then hot air above it, for example, the light can actually come from much further back in the horizon than it would be otherwise.
It's a lens to a storm very far away.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, I got a great idea, Kathleen. I don't know how if you go on the internet at all, but there's this thing called the internet. And we have WAMC.org. And if you go to WAMC.org/VoxPop, there's a spot you can put your comments in. And maybe if you put yours in there, if Patricia is still listening, she will put her comments in there, and you guys can compare notes and see if this happened on the same night, which would be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. But can you tell me where Walden is exactly from Albany? I think that's where she said she was from.
I want to say it is in Dutchess County. No, Orange County?
I don't know.
You know, I don't have the map in front of me, but...
But it is also south of Albany, then.
Yeah.
I believe so.
Uh-huh.
All right. And again, try WAMC.org/VoxPop. Maybe you two can correspond that way. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. Let's go to Chip in Albany. Chip.
Hello, Ray.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yep, you're on.
Yeah. So, first off, great program.
Thank you.
I'm a fan of it for a long time. Just two comments I hope will be taken constructively. One is on the wind generator blade.
Sure.
Yep.
The design of blades is very well worked out in propeller theory, and the theoretical most efficient propeller blade would be a single blade propeller with a long, thin blade on it.
Hmm.
But given different types of applications, think, for example, a ship, you may have 4 to 5 blades with very large blade diameter to generate thrust through the medium of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that you have three-bladed wind generators is because you're looking for a high efficiency. Think like a helicopter, for example, where a thin blade and fewer of them is going to be much more efficient for the generation of the spin that you need from low-speed winds, as well as being able to operate in high-speed winds as well.
Makes sense.
And the second little piece, I know there was just a quip when one of the guests on there mentioned that nothing grows in sand dunes. I just have to take exception with that because there's quite a robust flora and fauna in both active sand dunes. When you think both of grasses and flowering plants that are found there that are all early succession plants to help stabilize those dunes, not to mention that, but also on historical dune found formations like the Florida Highlands, where you have historic dunes that are now populated by what's called a scrub forest.
Hmm.
The same is found in the Pine Barrens, for example, or on Long Island. Northern California along the coast has a similar flora, and right in our own backyard we have the Pine Barrens that are all based upon dunes where you have really quite an extensive flora that's found there.
All right.
So, and that's...
Anyway, a tip of the hat to the guys there. Thanks for being there.
That's okay. That's
Chip,
why
nice
I'm a geologist.
Job.
You bet. See you, bye.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. You know, we have smart listeners. That's the bottom line here. All right, here are a few from email, and then we'll get back to the phones. This is from Mike, who is weighing in on the mysterious light situation. Could it be arc flash? High-powered lines and transformers can create bright purple flashes. That's from Mike in Hudson.
They'd stay in the same location.
Absolutely.
And
probably wouldn't see them over long distances
Again, that depends on the refraction of the atmosphere, but probably not.
I've seen those.
Very bright, though.
Yeah.
I've seen them, too.
I remember a transformer arcing, and I think the transformer ultimately blew up, but the snow was coming down, and it was a purple. It was quite impressive. Yeah, it was nice to see. All right, here's another one from Willie, and the subject is slowing, stopping, storing, moving, and re-emitting light. Please explain the molecular activity between light and a deactivated sodium cloud that slows, stops, stores, repositions, and re-emits light.
Oh, that's more hardcore physics than I'm prepared to.
Congratulations, you've stumped the band.
Stumped the chumps.
Ed, do you want to have a shot?
No.
Okay. All right, Willie, a gold star for you. And then this is just a... Just a greeting says, hi, Jim. I'm formerly of GE Plastics, now Molding Plastics in China. Keep up the good work on the science forum. That's from Carl in China.
Oh,
you want to see the name?
Yeah, my fan club.
Yeah, you got a lot of fans here today. All right.
Are they all in China?
Well, back to the phones we go. It's Layla in Mount Tremper. Layla.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I don't know if this question is out of anyone's B-A-I-L-I-W-I-C-K. I had a
couple of really ferocious bear attacks on our chicken coop, which is unusual. And my question is, if you all know what factors are at play when a bear decides to go into hibernation, like would the recent cold snap get them wanting to go in earlier and therefore trying to stock up on food at the last minute? Is it the length of days and doesn't have to do with temperature? Does it have to do with, you know, when they've had enough food in the fall and they feel
they're ready,
like they can do the winter? Like, what factors are at play?
I love this question. Do you guys have any idea?
It's a beautiful question. Jim?
Yeah, I do not know.
Oh, boy. That's two in a row that have stumped the band. I wish we had probably Helen. Here. Or you think Barbara would?
She'd know it for sure.
Okay. Well, tell you what, Layla, if you can hold that thought, I would suspect on the next Science Forum next month, we will have somebody here who can answer that.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks by that time, they'll be hibernating anyway, so it'll be okay.
Hopefully. Let's go to Steve in Kingston. Steve, you're on.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
Why do we have to assume that the water on Earth had to come from some external source? Why couldn't it just be formed here just like it was formed on the comets?
Well, first of all, cometary water probably formed during the early phases of the formation of the planets. Uranus and Neptune, for example, are mostly ice, and comets are made of the same material. As far as the water in the oceans, there's all sorts of possibilities. Some people think it comes from volcanoes, because volcanoes give off a lot of water vapor when they produce. Some people think it comes from breakdown of rock as well. So that's only one of the possibilities, and we don't really know where the oceans came from. But many astronomers now believe that they may have at least in part come from cometary effects. So it's an open question. We don't have an answer for it.
Ed, would any of the primordial water have survived the heating as the Earth had,
as it cooled down?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of it may have come out at that time, because chances are plate tectonics was probably very, very active early on. And as such, there would be a lot of volcanic activity. So the atmosphere would be filled with vapor. Mm. And a lot of that could have condensed then to form the oceans as soon as it could.
All right. Well, Steve, that's a real good question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. Dottie in, is it Warwick, Dottie?
Yes, Ray. How are you?
Good. You're on.
Good. Thanks. I just wanted to let you know, yes, Walden is in Orange County, Northern Orange County.
Okay.
And my comment is, I'm wondering about the flashing lights. Do you think it could have been the Aurora Borealis or Northern Lights? I've seen them here in Warwick. It was back in the 90s, I must say. But it was a very clear, cold night. And I didn't know if that might be something that we could see again, or is there just too much light pollution?
Well, depends on where you are.
You can see them. There haven't been a lot in the south these days. If you go to a site called spaceweather.com, it actually announces when auroras are about to hit. And there's supposed to be one,
cool.
for example, on the 20th, which is tomorrow.
Really?
Or tonight.
Oh.
We're expecting a CME to come in, effectively an eruption from the sun that hits the atmosphere.
I'm with you, Dottie, though. I've been waiting for a good one for a long time.
So what was the website, guys?
Spaceweather.com.
Gotcha. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Keep watching the skies, Dottie. Let's go quickly. Phyllis in Rhinebeck. You only have about 30 seconds to pose the question, Phyllis.
Well, I was up in Gros Morne Park this summer, and the Earth's mantle is visible up there. And I'm wondering, is that the case anywhere else?
Yes, actually. I lived in Newfoundland for 15 years,
wow.
my dear. And the Earth's mantle is available in Cyprus. It's available in a number of places. It's called ophiolite, and it occurs whenever a ridge gets abducted. When it comes, a ridge is very hot, and so it doesn't want to go down the tubes when ocean closes. So sometimes it winds up on the surface. So at Gros Morne, that orange rock you saw there, that was mantle, and you can see that in a lot of places in the world.
So are there some great elements there that we don't usually find?
It's made of olivine, which is iron magnesium silicate. And it's basically what we think the mantle's made out of.
Okay.
So it's there. It's a beautiful place.
Outstanding. Phyllis, we're out of time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, Ed Stander, you got 12 seconds to make a final statement. Okay, Jim.
B-A-I-L-I-W-I-C-K. It will be written on my tombstone.
Yep. What he says, I agree.
Fair enough. All right, we're done. Support comes from Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering workshops for adults and teens in a farm setting. Open 3 weekends in November featuring make-your-own glass-blown ornaments and work from 200 artists. Snowfarm.org. East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals. EastHeaven.com for information. Valley Home Improvement, designing and building kitchens, bathrooms, interiors, and additions throughout the Pioneer Valley. Love your home, valleyhomeimprovement.com. And Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. Legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors, currancompliance.com. Thanks again to Ed Stander and Jim Pickett, and to, Zach Malloy was at the controls for the show. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the calls. Thanks to you at home for calling and for listening. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Wildlife with Ward Stone. Stay tuned now for a news update.